she could have some bumps on one side and some flat areas directly across, so the three diameters would match, but the sections wouldn't fit. "Yes, yes," they say. "We get bumps like that. We call them nipples." The only woman there said, "It's got nothing to do with me," and everybody laughed. "We get nipples all the time," they continued. "We've been trying to tell the supervisor about it, but we never get anywhere." We were talking details, and that works wonders. I would ask questions based on what could happen theoretically, but to them it looked like I was a regular guy who knew about their technical problems. They loosened up very rapidly and told me all kinds of ideas they had to improve things. For example, when they use the rounding machine, they have to put a rod through holes exactly opposite each other. There are 180 holes, so they have to make sure the other end of the rod goes through the hole 90 holes away. Now, it turns out you have to climb up into an awkward place to count the holes. It's very slow and very difficult. They thought it would be very helpful if there were four painted marks, 90 degrees apart, put on at the factory. That way, they would never have to count more than 22 holes to the nearest mark. For example, if they put the rod through a hole which is 9 holes clockwise from a paint mark, then the other end of the rod would go through the hole which is 9 holes clockwise from the opposite mark. The foreman, Mr. Fichtel, said he wrote a memo with the suggestion to his superiors 2 years ago, but nothing had happened yet. When he asked why, he was told the suggestion was too expensive. "Too expensive to paint 4 little lines?" I said in disbelief. They all laughed. "It's not the paint, it's the paperwork," Mr. Fichtel said. They would have to revise all the manuals. The assembly workers had other observations and suggestions. They were concerned that if two rocket sections scrape as they're being put together, metal filings could get into the rubber seals and damage them. They even had some suggestions for redesigning the seal. Those suggestions weren't very good, but the point is, the workers were thinking. I got the impression that they were not undisciplined. They were very interested in what they were doing, but they weren't being given much encouragement. Nobody was paying much attention to them. It was remarkable that their morale was as high as it was under the circumstances. Then the workers began to talk to the boss, who had stayed. "We're disappointed by something," one of them said. When the commission was going to see the booster rocket assembly, the demonstration was going to be done by the managers. "Why wouldn't you let us do it?" "We were afraid you'd be frightened by the commissioners and you wouldn't want to do it." "No, no," said the workman. "We think we do a good job, and we wanted to show what we do." After that meeting, the boss took me to the cafeteria. As we were eating, the workmen weren't with us anymore. He said, "I was surprised they were so concerned about that." Later, I talked to Mr. Fichtel about this incident of increasing the pressure past 1,200. He showed me the notes he made as he went along. They weren't the formal papers that are stamped. They were part of an informal but carefully written diary. I said, "I hear the pressure got up to 1,350. "Yes," he said. "We had tightened the nut at the other end." "Was that the regular procedure?" "Oh, yes," he said. "It's in the book." He opens up the manual and shows me the procedure. It says, "Build up the pressure on the hydraulic jack. If this is insufficient to obtain desired roundness, then very carefully tighten nut on other end to get to the desired roundness." It said so in black and white. It didn't say that tightening the nut would increase the pressure past 1,200 psi. The people who wrote the manual probably weren't quite aware of that. Mr. Fichtel had written in his diary, "We very carefully tightened the nut," exactly the same language as the instructions. I said, "Mr. Lamberth told me he admonished you about going over 1,200. "He never admonished me about that. Why should he?" We figured out what probably happened. Mr. Lamberth's admonishment went down through the levels until somebody in middle management realized that Mr. Fichtel had gone by the book, and that the error was in the manual. But instead of telling Mr. Lamberth about the error, they simply threw away the admonishment and just kept quiet. Over lunch, Mr. Fichtel told me about the inspection procedures. "There's a sheet for each procedure, like this one for the rounding procedure," he said. "On it there are boxes for stamps, one from the supervisor, one from quality control, one from the manufacturer, and for the bigger jobs, one from NASA." He continued, "We make the measurements, go through one course of rounding, then make the measurements again. If they don't match well enough, we repeat the steps. Finally, when the diameter differences are small enough, we go for it. I woke up. What do you mean, go for it? I said. It sounds sort of cavalier. No, no, he says. That's just the lingo we use when we mean that all the conditions are satisfied, and we're ready to move to the next phase of the operation. Do you ever write that down, that go for it? Yes, sometimes. Let's see if we can find a place where you wrote it. Mr. Fichtel looked through his diary and found an example. The expression was completely natural to him. It wasn't reckless or cavalier. It was just his way of speaking. On Monday and Tuesday, while I was running around down at Kennedy, Mr. Rogers was in Washington appearing before a Senate committee. Congress was considering whether it should have its own investigation. Senator Hollings from South Carolina was giving Mr. Rogers a hard time. Secretary Rogers, he says, I'm anxious that you have an adequate staff there. How many investigators does your commission have? Mr. Rogers says, we don't have investigators in the police sense. We're reading documents, understanding what they mean, organizing hearings, talking to witnesses, that sort of thing. We'll have an adequate staff, I assure you. Well, that's the point, Senator Hollings says. From my experience in investigating cases, I'd want 4 or 5 investigators steeped in science and space technology going around down there at Canaveral, talking to everybody, eating lunch with them. You'd be amazed if you eat in the restaurants around there for 2 or 3 weeks. What you'll find out, you can't just sit and read what's given to you. We're not just going to sit and read, Mr. Rogers says defensively. We've gotten a lot of people in a room and asked them questions all at the same time, rather than have a gumshoe walking around talking to people one at a time. I understand, says Senator Hollings, yet I'm concerned about your product if you don't have some gumshoes. That's the trouble with presidential commissions. I've been on 'em. They go on what's fed to 'em, and they don't look behind it. Then we end up with investigative reporters, people writing books, and everything else. People are still investigating the Warren Commission report around this town. Note for foreign readers. The Warren Report was issued in 1964 by the Warren Commission, headed by retired Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren, which investigated the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. End of note. Mr. Rogers calmly says, I appreciate your comments, Senator. You'll be interested to know that one of our commission members, he's a Nobel laureate, is down there in Florida today, investigating in the way you'd like him to investigate. Mr. Rogers didn't know it, but I was actually eating lunch with some engineers when he said that. Senator Hollings says, I'm not questioning the competence of the Nobel laureate. I've been reading with great interest what he said. There's no question about the competence of the commission itself. It's just that when you investigate a case, you need investigators. You've already brought to the public's attention a lot of very interesting facts, so I think you haven't been negligent in any fashion. So I saved Mr. Rogers a little bit. He saw that he had an answer for Mr. Hollings by the good luck that I stayed in Florida anyway, against his wishes. Fantastic Figures. On Tuesday afternoon, I flew back to Washington and went to the next meeting of the commission, on Wednesday. It was another public meeting. A manager of the Thiokol Company named Mr. Lund was testifying. On the night before the launch, Mr. Malloy had told him to put on his management hat instead of his engineering hat, so he changed his opposition to launch and overruled his own engineers. I was asking him some harsh questions when suddenly I had this feeling of the Inquisition. Mr. Rogers had pointed out to us that we ought to be careful with these people, whose careers depend on us. He said, "We have all the advantages. We're sitting up here, they're sitting down there. They have to answer our questions, we don't have to answer their questions." Suddenly all this came back to me, and I felt terrible, and I couldn't do it the next day. I went back to California for a few days to recover. While I was in Pasadena, I went over to JPL and met with Jerry Solomon and Meemong Lee. They were studying the flame, which appeared a few seconds before the main fuel tank exploded, and were able to bring out all kinds of details. JPL has good enhancers of TV pictures from all their experience with planetary missions. Later, I took the enhancements over to Charlie Stevenson and his crew at Kennedy to expedite things. Somewhere along the line, somebody from the staff brought me something to sign. It said that my expenses were so-and-so much, but they weren't. They were more. I said, "This is not the amount I actually spent." The guy said, "I know that, sir. You're only allowed a maximum of $75 a day for the hotel and food." "Then why did you guys set me up in a hotel which costs $80 or $90 a night, and then you give me only $75 a day?" "Yes, I agree, it's too bad, but that's the way it goes. I thought of Mr. Rogers' offer to put me in a good hotel." "What did he mean by that? That it would cost me more?"
"If you're asked to contribute months of time and effort to the government, and you lose money you would have made consulting for a company, the government ought to appreciate it a little more than to be cheap about paying you back. I'm not trying to make money off the government, but I'm not wanting to lose money either." I said, "I'm not going to sign this."
Mr. Rogers came over and promised he would straighten it out, so I signed the paper. I really think Mr. Rogers tried to fix it, but he was unable to. I thought of fighting this one to the end, but then I realized it's impossible. If I had been paid for my actual expenses, then of course all the other commissioners would have to be paid too. That would be all right, but it would also mean that this commission was the only commission to be paid its actual expenses, and pretty soon word would get out. They have a saying in New York, "You can't fight City Hall," meaning it's impossible. But this time it was a hell of a lot bigger than City Hall. The $75 a day rule is a law of the United States. It might have been fun to fight it to the end, but I guess I was tired. I'm not as young as I used to be, so I just gave up. Somebody told me they heard commissioners make $1,000 a day, but the truth is, our government doesn't even pay their costs. At the beginning of March, about a month after the commission started, we finally split up into working groups. The pre-launch activities group was headed by Mr. Acheson. Mr. Sutter was in charge of the design, development, and production panel. General Katina was leader of the accident analysis group, and Dr. Ride was in charge of the mission planning and operations group. I spent most of my time in Katina's group. I was in Ride's group, too, but I ended up not doing very much for her. General Katina's group went to Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, to do its work. The first thing that happened there was a man named Ulian came in to tell us something. As range safety officer at Kennedy, Mr. Ulian had to decide whether to put destruct charges on the shuttle. If a rocket goes out of control, the destruct charges enable it to be blown up into small bits. That's much less perilous than a rocket flying around loose, ready to explode when it hits the ground. Every unmanned rocket has these charges. Mr. Ulian told us that 5 out of 127 rockets that he looked at had failed, a rate of about 4%. He took that 4% and divided it by 4, because he assumed a manned flight would be safer than an unmanned one. He came out with about a 1% chance of failure, and that was enough to warrant the destruct charges. But NASA told Mr. Ulian that the probability of failure was more like 1 in 10 to the 5th power. I tried to make sense out of that number. "Did you say 1 in 10 to the 5th power?" "That's right. 1 in 100,000. That means you could fly the shuttle every day for an average of 300 years between accidents. Every day, one flight for 300 years, which is obviously crazy."
"Yes, I know," said Mr. Ulian. "I moved my number up to 1 in 1,000 to answer all of NASA's claims that they were much more careful with manned flights, that the typical rocket isn't a valid comparison, etc., and put the destruct charges on anyway." But then a new problem came up. The Jupiter probe, Galileo, was going to use a power supply that runs on heat generated by radioactivity. If the shuttle carrying Galileo failed, radioactivity could be spread over a large area. So the argument continued. NASA kept saying 1 in 100,000, and Mr. Ulian kept saying 1 in 1,000 at best. Mr. Ulian also told us about the problems he had in trying to talk to the man in charge, Mr. Kingsbury. He could get appointments with underlings, but he never could get through to Kingsbury and find out how NASA got its figure of 1 in 100,000. The details of the story I can't remember exactly, but I thought Mr. Ulian was doing everything sensibly. Our panel supervised the tests that NASA was doing to discover the properties of the seals, how much pressure the putty could take, and so on, in order to find out exactly what had happened. General Katina didn't want to jump to conclusions,
So we went over and over things, checking all the evidence and seeing how well everything fitted together. There was an awful lot of detailed discussion about exactly what happened in the last few seconds of the flight, but I didn't pay much attention to any of it. It was as though a train had crashed because the track had a gap in it, and we were analyzing which cars broke apart first, which cars broke apart second, and why some car turned over on its side. I figured once the train goes off the track, it doesn't make any difference. It's done. I became bored. So I made up a game for myself. Imagine that something else had failed, the main engines, for instance, and we were making the same kind of intensive investigation as we are now. Would we discover the same slipping safety criteria and lack of communication? I thought I would do my standard thing, find out from the engineers how the engine works, what all the dangers are, what problems they've had, and everything else, and then, when I'm all loaded up so I know what I'm talking about, I'd confront whoever was claiming the probability of failure was 1 in 100,000. I asked to talk to a couple of engineers about the engines. The guy says, "Okay, I'll fix it up. Is 9 tomorrow morning okay?" This time there were three engineers, their boss, Mr. Lovingood, and a few assistants, about 8 or 9 people. Everybody had big, thick notebooks full of papers, all nicely organized. On the front they said, "Report on material given to Commissioner Richard P. Feynman on March Wawa," note, Feynman's way of saying whatever it was, end of note, 1986. I said, "Geez, you guys must have worked hard all night." "No, it's not so much work. We just put in the regular papers that we use all the time." I said, "I just wanted to talk to a few engineers. There are so many problems to work on, I can't expect you all to stay here and talk to me." But this time, everybody stayed. Mr. Lovingood got up and began to explain everything to me in the usual NASA way, with charts and graphs, which matched the information in my big book, all with bullets, of course. "I won't bother you with all the details, but I wanted to understand everything about the engine, so I kept asking my usual dumb-sounding questions. After a while, Mr. Lovingood says, "Dr. Feynman, we've been going for 2 hours now. There are 123 pages, and we've only covered 20 so far." My first reaction was to say, "Well, it isn't really going to take such a long time. I'm always a little slow at the beginning. It takes me a while to catch on. We'll be able to go much faster near the end." But then I had a second thought. I said, "In order to speed things up, I'll tell you what I'm doing, so you'll know where I'm aiming. I want to know whether there's the same lack of communication between the engineers and the management who are working on the engine as we found in the case of the booster rockets." Mr. Lovingood says, "I don't think so. As a matter of fact, although I'm now a manager, I was trained as an engineer." "All right," I said. "Here's a piece of paper each. Please write on your paper the answer to this question. What do you think is the probability that a flight would be uncompleted due to a failure in this engine?" They write down their answers and hand in their papers. One guy wrote, 99 44/100% pure, copying the Ivory Soap slogan, meaning about 1 in 200. Another guy wrote something very technical and highly quantitative in the standard statistical way, carefully defining everything that I had to translate, which also meant about 1 in 200. The third guy wrote simply, 1 in 300. Mr. Lovingood's paper, however, said, "Cannot quantify. Reliability is judged from bullet, past experience, bullet, quality control and manufacturing, bullet, engineering judgment." "Well," I said, "I've got 4 answers, and one of them weaseled." I turned to Mr. Lovingood. "I think you weaseled." "I don't think I weaseled." "You didn't tell me what your confidence was, sir. You told me how you determined it. What I want to know is, after you determined it, what was it?" He says, 100%. The engineer's jaws drop. My jaw drops. I look at him. Everybody looks at him. Minus epsilon. So I say, "Well, yes, that's fine. Now the only problem is, what is epsilon?" He says, 10^-5 power. It was the same number that Mr. Ullian had told us about. 1 in 100,000. I showed Mr. Lovingood the other answers and said, "You'll be interested to know that there is a difference between engineers and management here, a factor of more than 300. He says, "Sir,
I'll be glad to send you the document that contains this estimate, so you can understand it. Note. Later, Mr. Lovingood sent me that report. It said things like, the probability of mission success is necessarily very close to one. Does that mean it is close to one, or it ought to be close to one? And, historically, this high degree of mission success has given rise to a difference in philosophy between unmanned and manned spaceflight programs, i.e., numerical probability versus engineering judgment. As far as I can tell, engineering judgment means they're just going to make up numbers. The probability of an engine blade failure was given as a universal constant, as if all the blades were exactly the same, under the same conditions. The whole paper was quantifying everything. Just about every nut and bolt was in there. The chance that an HP-HTP pipe will burst is 10 to the negative 7th. You can estimate things like that. A probability of 1 in 10 million is almost impossible to estimate. It was clear that the numbers for each part of the engine were chosen so that when you add everything together, you get 1 in 100,000. End of note. I said, thank you very much. Now let's get back to the engine. So we continued, and just like I guessed, we went faster near the end. I had to understand how the engine worked, the precise shape of the turbine blades, exactly how they turned, and so on, so I could understand its problems. After lunch, the engineers told me all the problems of the engines. Blades cracking in the oxygen pump, blades cracking in the hydrogen pump, casings getting blisters and cracks, and so on. They look for these things with periscopes and special instruments when the shuttle came down after each flight. There was a problem called subsynchronous whirl, in which the shaft gets bent into a slightly parabolic shape at high speed. The wear on the bearings was so terrible, all the noise and the vibration, that it seemed hopeless. But they had found a way to get rid of it. There were about a dozen very serious problems. About half of them were fixed. Most airplanes are designed from the bottom up, with parts that have already been extensively tested. The shuttle, however, was designed from the top down, to save time. But whenever a problem was discovered, a lot of redesigning was required in order to fix it.
Mr. Lovingood isn't saying much now, but different engineers, depending on which problem it is, are telling me all this stuff, just like I could have found out if I went down to the engineers at Thiokol.
I gained a great deal of respect for them. They were all very straight, and everything was great. We went all the way down to the end of the book. We made it. Then I said, what about this high-frequency vibration where some engines get it and others don't? Note. I had heard about this from Bill Graham. He said that when he was first on the job as head of NASA, he was looking through some reports and noticed a little bullet. Bullet. 4,000 cycle vibration is within our database. He thought that was a funny-looking phrase, so he began asking questions. When he got all the way through, he discovered it was a rather serious matter. Some of the engines would vibrate so much that they couldn't be used. He used it as an example of how difficult it is to get information unless you go down and check on it yourself. End of note. There's a quick motion, and a little stack of papers appears. It's all put together nicely. It fits nicely into my book. It's all about the 4,000 cycle vibration. Maybe I'm a little dull, but I tried my best not to accuse anybody of anything. I just let them show me what they showed me, and acted like I didn't see their trick. I'm not the kind of investigator you see on TV, who jumps up and accuses the corrupt organization of withholding information. But I was fully aware that they hadn't told me about the problem until I asked about it. I usually acted quite naive, which I was for the most part. At any rate, the engineers all leapt forward. They got all excited and began to describe the problem to me. I'm sure they were delighted, because technical people love to discuss technical problems with technical people who might have an opinion or a suggestion that could be useful. And, of course, they were very anxious to cure it. They kept referring to the problem by some complicated name, a pressure-induced vorticity oscillatory wah-wah or something. I said, oh, you mean a whistle? Yes, they said. It exhibits the characteristics of a whistle. They thought the whistle could be coming from a place where the gas rushed through a pipe at high speed and split into three smaller pipes, where there were two partitions. They explained how far they had gotten in figuring out the problem. When I left the meeting, I had the definite impression that I had found the same game as with the SEALs. Management reducing criteria and accepting more and more errors that weren't designed into the device, while the engineers are screaming from below, "Help!" and "This is a red alert!" The next evening, on my way home in the airplane, I was having dinner. After I finished buttering my roll, I took the little piece of thin cardboard that the butter pat comes on and bent it around in a U-shape so there were two edges facing me. I held it up and started blowing on it, and pretty soon I got it to make a noise like a whistle. Back in California, I got some more information on the shuttle engine and its probability of failure. I went to Rocketdyne and talked to engineers who were building the engines. I also talked to consultants for the engine. In fact, one of them, Mr. Covert, was on the commission. I also found out that a Caltech professor had been a consultant for Rocketdyne. He was very friendly and informative, and told me about all the problems the engine had, and what he thought the probability of failure was. I went to JPL and met a fellow who had just written a report for NASA on the methods used by the FAA. Note for foreign readers, Federal Aviation Administration. End of note. And the military, to certify their gas turbine and rocket engines. We spent the whole day going back and forth over how to determine the probability of failure in a machine.
I learned a lot of new names, like Weibull, a particular mathematical distribution that makes a certain shape on a graph. He said that the original safety rules for the shuttle were very similar to those of the FAA, but that NASA had modified them as they began to get problems. It turned out that NASA's Marshall Space Center in Huntsville designed the engine. Rocketdyne built them, Lockheed wrote the instructions, and NASA's Kennedy Space Center installed them. It may be a genius system of organization, but it was a complete fuzz-dazzle as far as I was concerned. It got me terribly confused. I didn't know whether I was talking to the Marshall man, the Rocketdyne man, the Lockheed man, or the Kennedy man. So in the middle of all this, I got lost. In fact, all during this time, in March and April, I was running back and forth so much between California, Alabama, Houston, Florida, and Washington, D.C., that I often didn't know what day it was or where I was. After all this investigating on my own, I thought I'd write up a little report on the engine for the other commissioners. But when I looked at my notes on the testing schedules, there was some confusion. There would be talk about engine number 12 and how long the engine flew. But no engine ever was like that. It would be repaired all the time. After each flight, technicians would inspect the engines and see how many cracked blades there were on the rotor, how many splits there were in the casing, and so on. Then they'd repair the engine by putting on a new casing, a new rotor, or new bearings. They would replace lots of parts. So I would read that a particular engine had rotor number 2009, which had run for 27 minutes in flight such-and-such, and casing number 4091, which had run for 53 minutes in flights such-and-such, and so-and-so. It was all mixed up. When I finished my report, I wanted to check it. So the next time I was at Marshall, I said I wanted to talk to the engineers about a few very technical problems, just to check the details. I didn't need any management there. This time, to my surprise, nobody came but the three engineers I had talked to before, and we straightened everything out. When I was about to leave, one of them said, "You know that question you asked us last time, with the papers? We felt that was a loaded question. It wasn't fair." I said, "Yes, you're quite right. It was a loaded question. I had an idea of what would happen." The guy says, "I would like to revise my answer. I want to say that I cannot quantify it." This guy was the one who had the most detailed answer before. I said, "That's fine, but do you agree that the chance of failure is 1 in 100,000? Well, no, I don't. I just don't want to answer. Then one of the other guys says, "I said it was 1 in 300, and I still say it's 1 in 300, but I don't want to tell you how I got my number." I said, "It's okay. You don't have to." An inflamed appendix. All during this time, I had the impression that somewhere along the line, the whole commission would come together again so we could talk to each other about what we had found out. In order to aid such a discussion, I thought I'd write little reports along the way. I wrote about my work with the ice crew, analyzing the pictures and the faulty temperature readings. I wrote about my conversations with Mr. Lamberth and the assembly workers, and I even wrote about the piece of paper that said, "Let's go for it." All these little reports I sent to Al Keel, the executive officer, to give to the other commissioners. Now, this particular adventure, investigating the lack of communication between the managers and the engineers who were working on the engine, I also wrote about on my little IBM PC at home. I was kind of tired, so I didn't have the control I wanted. It wasn't written with the same care as my other reports. But since I was writing it only as a report to the other commissioners, I didn't change the language before I sent it on to Dr. Keel. I simply attached a note that said, "I think the other commissioners would be interested in this, but you can do with it what you want. It's a little strong at the end." He thanked me and said he sent my report to everybody. Then I went to the Johnson Space Center in Houston to look into the avionics. Sally Ride's group was there, investigating safety matters in connection with the astronauts' experiences. Sally introduced me to the software engineers, and they gave me a tour of the training facilities for the astronauts. It's really quite wonderful. There are different kinds of simulators with varying degrees of sophistication that the astronauts practice on. One of them is just like the real thing. You climb up, you get in. At the windows, computers are producing pictures. When the pilot moves the controls, the view out of the windows changes. This particular simulator had the double purpose of teaching the astronauts and checking the computers. In the back of the crew area, there were trays full of cables running down through the cargo bay to somewhere in the back, where instruments simulated signals from the engines, pressures, fuel flow rates, and so on. The cables were accessible because the technicians were checking for crosstalk, interferences in the signals going back and forth. The shuttle itself is operated essentially by computer. Once it's lit up and starts to go, nobody inside does anything, because there's tremendous acceleration. When the shuttle reaches a certain altitude, the computers adjust the engine thrust down for a little while, and as the air thins out, the computers adjust the thrust up again. About a minute later, the two solid rocket boosters fall away, and a few minutes after that, the main fuel tank falls away. Each operation is controlled by the computers. The shuttle gets into orbit automatically. The astronauts just sit there in their seats. The shuttle's computers don't have enough memory to hold all the programs for the whole flight. After the shuttle gets into orbit, the astronauts take out some tapes and load in the program for the next phase of the flight. There are as many as 6 in all. Near the end of the flight, the astronauts load in the program for coming down. The shuttle has 4 computers on board, all running the same programs. All 4 are normally in agreement. If one computer is out of agreement, the flight can still continue. If only 2 computers agree, the flight has to be curtailed and the shuttle brought back immediately. For even more safety, there's a 5th computer, located away from the other 4 computers, with its wires going on different paths, which has only the program for going up and the program for coming down. Both programs can barely fit into its memory. If something happens to the other computers, this 5th computer can bring the shuttle back down. It's never had to be used. The most dramatic thing is the landing. Once the astronauts know where they're supposed to land, they push one of 3 buttons, marked Edwards, White Sands, and Kennedy, which tells the computer where the shuttle's going to land. Then some small rockets slow the shuttle down a little and get it into the atmosphere at just the right angle. That's the dangerous part, where all the tiles heat up. During this time, the astronauts can't see anything, and everything's changing so fast that the descent has to be done automatically. At around 35,000 feet, the shuttle slows down to less than the speed of sound, and the steering can be done manually if necessary. But at 4,000 feet, something happens that is not done by the computer. The pilot pushes a button to lower the landing wheels. I found that very odd. A kind of silliness having to do with the psychology of the pilots. They're heroes in the eyes of the public. Everybody has the idea that they're steering the shuttle around, whereas the truth is, they don't have to do anything until they push that button to lower the landing gear. They can't stand the idea that they really have nothing to do. I thought it would be safer if the computer would lower the landing wheels in case the astronauts were unconscious for some reason. The software engineers agreed, and added that putting down the landing wheels at the wrong time is very dangerous. The engineers told me that ground control can send up the signal to lower the landing wheels, but this backup gave them some pause. What happens if the pilot is half-conscious and thinks the wheels should go down at a certain time, and the controller on the ground knows it's the wrong time? It's much better to have the whole thing done by computer. The pilot also used to control the brakes, but there was lots of trouble. If you brake too much at the beginning, you'd have no more brake pad material left when you reach the end of the runway, and you're still moving. So the software engineers were asked to design a computer program to control the braking. At first, the astronauts objected to the change, but now they're very delighted because the automatic braking works so well. Although there's a lot of good software being written at Johnson, the computers on the shuttle are so obsolete that the manufacturers don't make them anymore. The memories in them are the old kind, made with little ferrite cores that have wires going through them. In the meantime, we've developed much better hardware. The memory chips of today are much, much smaller. They have much greater capacity, and they're much more reliable. They have internal error-correcting codes that automatically keep the memory good. With today's computers, we can design separate program modules so that changing the payload doesn't require so much program rewriting. Because of the huge investment in the flight simulators and all the other hardware, to start all over again and replace the millions of lines of code that they've already built up would be very costly. I learned how the software engineers developed the avionics for the shuttle. One group would design the software programs in pieces. After that, the parts would be put together into huge programs and tested by an independent group. After both groups thought all the bugs had been worked out, they would have a simulation of an entire flight in which every part of the shuttle system is tested. In such cases, they had a principle. This simulation is not just an exercise to check if the programs are all right. It is a real flight. If anything fails now, it's extremely serious, as if the astronauts were really on board and in trouble. Your reputation is on the line. In the many years they had been doing this, they had only 6 failures at the level of flight simulation and not one in an actual flight. So the computer people looked like they knew what they were doing. They knew the computer business was vital to the shuttle, but potentially dangerous, and they were being extremely careful. They were writing programs that operate a very complex machine in an environment where conditions are changing drastically. Programs which measure those changes are flexible in their responses and maintain high safety and accuracy. I would say that in some ways, they were once in the forefront of how to ensure quality in robotic or interactive computer systems. But because of the obsolete hardware, it's no longer true today. I didn't investigate the avionics as extensively as I did the engines, so I might have been getting a little bit of a sales talk, but I don't think so. The engineers and the managers communicated well with each other, and they were all very careful not to change their criteria for safety. I told the software engineers I thought their system and their attitude were very good. One guy muttered something about higher-ups in NASA wanting to cut back on testing to save money. They keep saying we always pass the tests, so what's the use of having so many? Before I left Houston, I continued my surreptitious investigation of the rumor that the White House had put pressure on NASA to launch the shuttle. Houston is the center of communication, so I went over to the telemetry people and asked about their switching system. I went through the same stuff as I did in Florida, and they were just as nice to me. But this time I found out that if they wanted to tie in the shuttle to the Congress, the White House, or to anywhere, they needed a 3-minute warning. Not 3 months, not 3 days, not 3 hours, 3 minutes. Therefore, they can do it whenever they want, and nothing has to be written down in advance. So that was a blind alley. I talked to a New York Times reporter about this rumor one time. I asked him, "How do you find out if things like this are true?" He says, "One of the things I thought to do was to go down and talk to the people who run the switching system. I tried that, but I wasn't able to come up with anything." During the first half of April, General Katina's group received the final results of the tests NASA was making at Marshall. NASA included its own interpretations of the results, but we thought we should write everything over again in our own way. The only exceptions were when a test didn't show anything. General Katina set up a whole system at Marshall for writing our group's report. It lasted about 2 days. Before we could get anywhere, we got a message from Mr. Rogers. Come back to Washington. You shouldn't do the writing down there. So we went back to Washington, and General Katina gave me an office in the Pentagon. It was fine, but there was no secretary, so I couldn't work fast. Bill Graham had always been very cooperative, so I called him up. He arranged for me to use a guy's office. The guy was out of town, and his secretary. She was very, very helpful. She could write up something as fast as I could say it, and then she'd revamp it, correcting my mistakes. We worked very hard for about 2 or 3 days, and got large pieces of the report written that way. It worked very well. Neil Armstrong, who was in our group, is extremely good at writing. He would look at my work and immediately find every weak spot, just like that. He was right every time, and I was very impressed. Each group was writing a chapter or two of the main report. Our group wrote some of the stuff in Chapter 3, the accident, but our main work was Chapter 4, the cause of the accident. One result of this system, however, was that we never had a meeting to discuss what each of our groups found out, to comment on each other's findings from our different perspectives. Instead, we did what they call wordsmithing, or what Mr. Hotz later called tombstone engraving, correcting punctuation, refining phrases, and so on. We never had a real discussion of ideas, except incidentally in the course of this wordsmithing. For example, a question would come up. Should this sentence about the engines be worded this way or that way? I would try to get a little discussion started. From my own experiences, I got the impression that the engines aren't as good as you're saying here. So they'd say, then we'll use the more conservative wording here. And they'd go on to the next sentence. Perhaps that's a very efficient way to get a report out quickly, but we spent meeting after meeting doing this wordsmithing. Every once in a while we'd interrupt that to discuss the typography and the color of the cover. And after each discussion, we were asked to vote. I thought it would be most efficient to vote for the same color we had decided on in the meeting before. But it turned out I was always in the minority. We finally chose red. It came out blue. One time I was talking to Sally Ride about something I mentioned in my report on the engines, and she didn't seem to know about it. I said, "Didn't you see my report?" She says, "No, I didn't get a copy." So I go over to Keel's office and say, "Sally tells me she didn't get a copy of my report." He looks surprised and turns to his secretary. "Please make a copy of Dr. Feynman's report for Dr. Ride." Then I discover Mr. Acheson hasn't seen it. "Make a copy and give it to Mr. Acheson." I finally caught on, so I said, "Dr. Keel, I don't think anybody has seen my report." So he says to his secretary, "Please make a copy for all the commissioners and give it to them." Then I said to him, "I appreciate how much work you're doing and that it's very difficult to keep everything in mind, but I thought you told me that you showed my report to everybody." He says, "Yes, well, I meant all of the staff." I later discovered by talking to people on the staff that they hadn't seen it either. When the other commissioners finally got to see my report, most of them thought it was very good, and it ought to be in the commission report somewhere. Encouraged by that, I kept bringing up my report. "I'd like to have a meeting to discuss what to do with it," I kept saying. "We'll have a meeting about it next week," was the standard answer. We were too busy wordsmithing and voting on the color of the cover. Gradually, I realized that the way my report was written, it would require a lot of wordsmithing, and we were running out of time. Then somebody suggested that my report could go in as an appendix. That way, it wouldn't have to be wordsmithed to fit in with anything else. But some of the commissioners felt strongly that my report should go in the main report somehow. The appendices won't come out until months later, so nobody will read your report if it's an appendix, they said. I thought I'd compromise, however, and let it go in as an appendix. But now there was a new problem. My report, which I had written on my word processor at home, would have to be converted from the IBM format to the big document system the commission was using. They had a way of doing that with an optical scanning device. I had to go to a little bit of trouble to find the right guy to do it. Then it didn't get done right away. When I asked what happened, the guy said he couldn't find the copy I had given him. So I had to give him another copy. A few days later, I finished writing my report about the avionics, and I wanted to combine it with my report on the engines. So I took the avionics report to the guy, and I said, I'd like to put this in with my other report. Then I needed to see a copy of my new report for some reason, but the guy gave me an old copy before the avionics was added. Where's the new one with the avionics, I said. I can't find it, and so on. I don't remember all the details, but it seemed my report was always missing or half-cooked. It could easily have been mistakes, but there were too many of them. It was quite a struggle, nursing my report along. Then, in the last couple of days, when the main report is ready to be sent to the printer, Dr. Keel wants my report to be wordsmithed too, even though it's going in as an appendix. So I took it to the regular editor there, a capable man named Hansen, and he fixed it up without changing the sense of it. Then it was put back into the machine as version number 23. There were revisions and revisions. By the way, everything had 23 versions. It has been noted that computers, which are supposed to increase the speed at which we do things, have not increased the speed at which we write reports. We used to make only 3 versions, because they're so hard to type, and now we make 23 versions. The next day, I noticed Keel working on my report. He had put all kinds of big circles around whole sections with X's through them. There were all kinds of thoughts left out. He explained, "This part doesn't have to go in, because it says more or less what we said in the main report." I tried to explain that it's much easier to get the logic if all the ideas are together, instead of everything being distributed in little pieces all over the main report. "After all," I said, "it's only going to be an appendix. It won't make any difference if there's a little repetition." Dr. Keel put back something here and there when I asked him to, but there was still so much missing that my report wasn't anything like it was before. The 10th Recommendation. Sometime in May, at one of our last meetings, we got around to making a list of possible recommendations. Somebody would say, "Maybe one of the things we should discuss is the establishment of a safety board." "Okay, we'll put that down." I'm thinking, at last, we're going to have a discussion. But it turns out that this tentative list of topics becomes the recommendations, that there be a safety board, that there be a this, that there be a that. The only discussion was about which recommendation we should write first, which one should come second, and so forth. There were many things I wanted to discuss further. For example, in regard to a safety board, one could ask, "Wouldn't such a committee just add another layer to an already overgrown bureaucracy?" There had been safety boards before. In 1967, after the Apollo accident, the investigating committee at the time invented a special panel for safety. It worked for a while, but it didn't last. We didn't discuss why the earlier safety boards were no longer effective. Instead, we just made up more safety boards. We called them the Independent Solid Rocket Motor Design Oversight Committee, the Shuttle Transportation System Safety Advisory Panel, and the Office of Safety, Reliability, and Quality Assurance. We decided who would oversee each safety board, but we didn't discuss whether the safety boards created by our commission had any better chance of working, whether we could fix the existing boards so they would work, or whether we should have them at all. I'm not as sure about a lot of things as everybody else. Things need to be thought out a little bit, and we weren't doing enough thinking together. Quick decisions on important matters are not very good, and at the speed we were going, we were bound to make some impractical recommendations. We ended up rearranging the list of possible recommendations and wordsmithing them a little, and then we voted yes or no. It was an odd way of doing things, and I wasn't used to it. In fact, I got the feeling we were being railroaded. Things were being decided somehow, a little out of our control. At any rate, in our last meeting, we agreed to 9 recommendations. Many of the commissioners went home after that meeting, but I was going to New York a few days later, so I stayed in Washington. The next day, I happened to be standing around in Mr. Rogers' office with Neil Armstrong and another commissioner, when Rogers says, "I thought we should have a 10th recommendation. Everything in our report is so negative. I think we need something positive at the end to balance it." He shows me a piece of paper. It says, "The Commission strongly recommends that NASA continue to receive the support of the administration and the nation. The agency constitutes a national resource and plays a critical role in space exploration and development. It also provides a symbol of national pride and technological leadership. The Commission applauds NASA's spectacular achievements of the past and anticipates impressive achievements to come. The findings and recommendations presented in this report are intended to contribute to the future NASA successes that the nation both expects and requires as the 21st century approaches. In our 4 months of work as a commission, we had never discussed a policy question like that, so I felt there was no reason to put it in. And although I'm not saying I disagree with it, it wasn't obvious that it was true either. I said, "I think this 10th recommendation is inappropriate." I think I heard Armstrong say, "Well, if somebody's not in favor of it, I think we shouldn't put it in." But Rogers kept working on me. We argued back and forth a little bit, but then I had to catch my flight to New York. While I was in the airplane, I thought about this 10th recommendation some more. I wanted to lay out my arguments carefully on paper, so when I got to my hotel in New York, I wrote Rogers a letter. At the end, I wrote, "This recommendation reminds me of the NASA flight reviews. There are critical problems, but never mind. Keep on flying." It was Saturday, and I wanted Mr. Rogers to read my letter before Monday, so I called up his secretary. Everybody was working 7 days a week to get the report out in time, and I said, "I'd like to dictate a letter to you. Is that all right?" She says, "Sure. To save you some money, let me call you right back." She calls me back, I dictate the letter, and she hands it directly to Rogers. When I came back on Monday, Mr. Rogers said, "Dr. Feynman, I've read your letter, and I agree with everything it says, but you've been outvoted." Outvoted? How was I outvoted when there was no meeting? Keel was there, too. He says, "We called everybody, and they all agree with the recommendation. They all voted for it." "I don't think that's fair," I protested. "If I could have presented my arguments to the other commissioners, I don't think I'd have been outvoted." I didn't know what to do, so I said, "I'd like to make a copy of it." When I came back, Keel says, "We just remembered that we didn't talk to Hotz about it, because he was in a meeting. We forgot to get his vote." I didn't know what to make of that, but I found out later that Mr. Hotz was in the building, not far from the copy machine. Later, I talked to David Acheson about the 10th recommendation. He explained, "It doesn't really mean anything. It's only motherhood and apple pie." I said, "Well, if it doesn't mean anything, it's not necessary, then." If this were a commission for the National Academy of Sciences, your objections would be proper. "But don't forget," he says, "this is a presidential commission. We should say something for the president." "I don't understand the difference," I said. "Why can't I be careful and scientific when I'm writing a report to the president?" Being naive doesn't always work. My argument had no effect. Acheson kept telling me I was making a big thing out of nothing, and I kept saying it weakened our report and it shouldn't go in. So that's where it ended up. The commission strongly recommends that NASA continue to receive the support of the administration and the nation. All this motherhood and apple pie stuff to balance the report. While I was flying home, I thought to myself, it's funny that the only part of the report that was genuinely balanced was my own report. I said negative things about the engine and positive things about the avionics, and I had to struggle with them to get it in, even as a lousy appendix. I thought about the 10th recommendation. All the other recommendations were based on evidence we had found, but this one had no evidence whatsoever. I could see the whitewash dripping down. It was obviously a mistake. It would make our report look bad. I was very disturbed. When I got home, I talked to Joan, my sister. I told her about the 10th recommendation and how I had been outvoted. "Did you call any of the other commissioners and talk to them yourself?" she said. "Well, I talked to Acheson, but he was for it. Any others?" No. So I called up three other commissioners. I'll call them A, B, and C. I call A, who says, "What 10th recommendation?" I call B, who says, "10th recommendation? What are you talking about?" I call C, who says, "Don't you remember, you dope? I was in the office when Rogers first told us, and I don't see anything wrong with it." It appeared that the only people who knew about the 10th recommendation were the people who were in the office when Rogers told us. I didn't bother to make any more telephone calls. After all, it's enough. I didn't feel that I had to open all the safes to check that the combination is the same. Note: this refers to Safecracker meets Safecracker, another story told in "Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman." End of note. Then I told Joan about my report, how it was so emasculated, even though it was going in as an appendix. She says, "Well, if they do that to your report, what have you accomplished being on the commission? What's the result of all your work?" Aha! I sent a telegram to Mr. Rogers. "Please take my signature off the report unless two things occur. One, there is no 10th recommendation, and two, my report appears without modification from version number 23. I knew by this time I had to define everything carefully. In order to get the number of the version I wanted, I called Mr. Hotz, who was in charge of the documentation system and publishing the report. He sent me version number 23, so I had something definite to publish on my own if worst came to worst. The result of this telegram was that Rogers and Keel tried to negotiate with me. They asked General Katina to be the intermediary, because they knew he was a friend of mine. What a good friend of mine he was, they didn't know. Katina says, "Hello, Professor. I just wanted to tell you that I think you're doing very well, but I've been given the job of trying to talk you out of it, so I'm going to give you the arguments." "Fear not," I said. "I'm not going to change my mind. Just give me the arguments and fear not." The first argument was that if I don't accept the 10th recommendation, they won't accept my report, even as an appendix. I didn't worry about that one, because I could always put out my report myself. All the arguments were like that. None of them was very good, and none of them had any effect. I had thought through carefully what I was doing, so I just stuck to my guns. Then Katina suggested a compromise. They were willing to go along with my report as I wrote it, except for one sentence near the end. I looked at the sentence, and I realized that I had already made my point in the previous paragraph. Repeating the point amounted to polemics. Removing the phrase made my report much better. I accepted the compromise. Then I offered a compromise on the 10th recommendation. If they want to say something nice about NASA at the end, just don't call it a recommendation, so people will know that it's not in the same class as the other recommendations. Call it a concluding thought if you want. And to avoid confusion, don't use the words "strongly recommends." Just say "urges." The Commission urges that NASA continue to receive the support of the administration and the nation. All the other stuff can stay the same. A little bit later, Keel calls me up. "Can we say strongly urges?" "No, just urges." "Okay," he said. And that was the final decision. Meet the Press. I put my name on the main report. My own report got in as an appendix, and everything was all right. In early June, we went back to Washington and gave our report to the president in a ceremony held in the Rose Garden. That was on a Thursday. The report was not to be released to the public until the following Monday, so the president could study it. Meanwhile, the newspaper reporters were working like demons. They knew our report was finished, and they were trying to scoop each other to find out what was in it. I knew they would be calling me up day and night, and I was afraid I would say something about a technical matter that would give them a hint. Reporters are very clever and persistent. They'll say, "We heard such and such. Is it true?" And pretty soon what you're thinking you didn't tell them shows up in the newspaper. I was determined not to say a word about the report until it was made public on Monday. A friend of mine convinced me to go on the McNeil-Lehr NewsHour, so I said yes for Monday evening's show. I also had my secretary set up a press conference for Tuesday at Caltech. I said, "Tell the reporters who want to talk to me that I haven't any comment on anything. Any questions they have, I'll be glad to answer on Tuesday at my press conference." Over the weekend, while I was still in Washington, it leaked somehow that I had threatened to take my name off the report. Some paper in Miami started it, and soon the story was running all over about this argument between me and Rogers. When the reporters who were used to covering Washington heard Mr. Feynman has nothing to say, he'll answer all your questions at his press conference on Tuesday, it sounded suspicious, as though the argument was still on, and I was going to have this press conference on Tuesday to explain why I took my name off the report. But I didn't know anything about it. I isolated myself from the press so much that I wasn't even reading the newspapers. On Sunday night, the commission had a goodbye dinner arranged by Mr. Rogers at some club. After we finished eating, I said to General Katina, "I can't stay around anymore. I have to leave a little early." He says, "What can be so important?" I didn't want to say. He comes outside with me, to see what this important something is. It's a bright red sports car with two beautiful blondes inside, waiting to whisk me away. I get in the car. We're about to speed off, leaving General Katina standing there, scratching his head, when one of the blondes says, "Oh, General Katina, I'm..."